Persecutory guilt is simply a form of self-attack. It's tormenting, it's persecutory, it belongs to Klein's paranoid schizoid position, and it's narcissistic. People sometimes don't fully recognize the narcissism. That narcissism really belongs to the paranoid schizoid position, because in that position, you are feeling hunted by predators. When we're in the depressive reparative position, other people are real to us. We not only are able to empathize with them, I think of empathy as merely a cognitive act of knowing how you feel. Many psychopaths are wonderfully empathic. They know exactly how their victims feel. They just don't give a damn. We need to go beyond empathy to sympathy in the depressive position, where I not only know how you feel, but I care and I wish to relieve your pain.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. This podcast was created in order to share with our colleagues and the community at large the many activities that psychoanalysts are involved in around the world that go beyond their individual clinical work in their consulting rooms. We have conversations with psychoanalysts who work with medically ill patients, who work in refugee centers, who work in community mental health centers, who work with police departments, with the United Nations, with business leaders, analysts who teach undergraduates, who work in prisons. There's a whole variety of quite remarkable work that analysts are bringing to various venues around the world. When COVID struck us all, we shifted our attention and we began meeting with analysts and talking with analysts again around the world to learn firsthand how they were dealing with this crisis and with the sudden shift to online treatment. And we've learned that different cultures, analytic cultures and political cultures, entail both similarities and differences among each other in how we're all facing this crisis. As part of that effort, we also began speaking with some of the elders in our field. And by elders, I mean those who've been practicing analysis for 40 to 50 years. And we ask them to reflect on this quite unique period of history and to also share their vision of our profession and how it's evolved for them over their many decades. In addition, psychoanalysis has always had a point of view about the societies in which we live. And we've been discussing with clinicians and psychoanalytic researchers on this new wave of othernesses that has been almost virus-like in wrapping the world, where groups of people from all vantage points are being treated as cold others. And there's something about our common humanity that is more and more difficult for us to hold on to. And analysts have a great deal to say about that, and we've been discussing that with colleagues, again, from around the world. And we're going to continue focusing on these three areas: work that analysts do off the couch, reflections on what COVID is doing to all of us, and hopefully what it will be like for us as we leave COVID hopefully behind, and also the reflections that we analysts have on the societies in which we live. I hope you enjoy these conversations. Please feel free to comment on our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Don Carvith. Dr. Carvith is a training and supervising analyst at the Canadian Institute of Psychoanalysis in Toronto. In today's conversation, Dr. Carvith and I spend time on the careful delineation he has made over many years of writing and speaking between different levels of guilt. There's guilt that actually cares for the well-being of another person, and there's a different form of guilt, more of a self-torment, that's involved in narcissistic preoccupations, It's a difference that he emphasizes, and we discuss the history of those differences conceptually, and also how those differences are important for technically how one engages a patient who is struggling at different levels of functioning. We take up the issue of how the countertransference is an important vehicle through which we can appreciate the difference of where the patient is. And we take up the notion of self-revelation on the part of the analyst. That is, there's a difference between self-revelation as usually understood as a narcissistic function on the part of the analyst, that is looking for certain gratifications, and self-revelation that can be in service of helping the patient be object-related, that is, potentially deepening the treatment. Eventually, we end up discussing how the capacity to bear guilt is not only an internal intrapsychic issue, but also, according to Don, an issue about civilization and the maturity of the civilization. It's quite engaging, and I learned a lot, and I hope our listeners do. Don, in addition to being a training and supervising analyst, he's the past director of the Toronto Institute of Psychoanalysis. He's the past editor-in-chief of the Canadian Journal of Psychoanalysis. He's the author of The Still Small Voice, Psychoanalytic Reflections on Guilt and Conscience, and Psychoanalytic Thinking, A Dialectical Critique of Contemporary Theory and Practice. In the notes that will accompany this episode, you'll see his websites that list many of his publications and also his video lectures. I hope you find this as educational and enriching as I did. Here's my conversation with Dr. Don Carbeth. Don, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Harvey.
Don, a common symptom that patients bring to our offices is what can be loosely called rumination. Rumination is something we're all familiar with, of course, more or less. It's a state of mind where one gets stuck and starts churning in one's head in generally a monotonous or self-critical way. And it can be a chief complaint that people bring, or it can be a symptom that emerges over time alongside the rest of their psychology making itself known to us. And it exists in many shapes and forms. For patients who are three-dimensionally engaged in the world around them, these kinds of ruminations are generally short-lived, and they're isolated to specific areas of conflict. It could be in the face of a major accomplishment that people start this ruminating process, or if they have erotic or aggressive feelings that they're awkward about, they will paralyze themselves with rumination. Then there is another type of person and type of presentation that we see where the rumination is all-consuming. It sort of owns their life. Their egos are not three-dimensionally involved in the world, but they're more in survival mode all the time. And one of the ways they've learned since childhood often to survive is to be self-preoccupied in a narcissistic way. Betty Joseph came up with a term in 1982 that has always stayed with me. She calls it chuntering. Mm-hmm. And it really is a great description of how all-consuming this internal dialogue is. And by history with patients like that, you'll often encounter histories of trauma and also histories of affective disease, of which these chunterings can be an initial symptom. The importance of this is to understand where the person is coming from and the nature of the symptom and the character within which it's embedded. You need to understand it in order to know how to engage with it. And your work so beautifully helps us get inside the mind of patients because you describe different levels of guilt. Now, we're going to be careful with our terms because I know that's important to your work and we're going to unpack that. But as an introduction, there are different levels of guilt, whereas the more thriving individuals, their guilt and ruminations have to do with concerns for the object. They're actually interested in their impact on other people. And one might also, of course, call that being part of the depressive position. Alternatively, the persons who are more preoccupied internally on an ongoing basis, they're not really concerned with the object. They're concerned with their self-esteem, their need to view themselves well. And that's more obviously associated with the persecutory position. The best way I could ask you to elaborate it is by starting us off by quoting from your 2006 really lovely paper in the Canadian Journal of Psychoanalysis called Self-Punishment as Guilt Evasion. A couple of sentences, quote, "Conscience and guilt involve the depressive anxiety and the capacity for concern for the object characterizing the depressive position and motivating the desire to make reparation. They are manifestations of attachment and love. The unconscious need for punishment, on the other hand, reflects the narcissism, shame, and persecutory anxiety of the paranoid schizoid position. It is a manifestation of aggression and hate. As a guilt substitute, the unconscious need for punishment should not be conflated with the guilt it evades." Let me read that again because it's a central point you make. "As a guilt substitute, the unconscious need for punishment should not be conflated with the guilt it evades." Don, tell us about this.
Right. Well, Freud did conflate the unconscious need for punishment with the guilt it evades. He didn't really recognize two fundamentally different types of guilt. It's really to Melanie Klein and Leon Grinberg that we really owe the clear distinction. At least that's where I found it most clearly set forth, especially in Grinberg's work. I think his article was called Two Types of Guilt. So-called persecutory guilt versus so-called depressive or reparative guilt. I prefer to call it reparative guilt. Persecutory guilt is simply a form of self-attack. It's tormenting. It's persecutory. It belongs to Klein's paranoid schizoid position, and it's narcissistic. People sometimes don't fully recognize that that narcissism really belongs to the paranoid schizoid position, because in that position, you are feeling hunted by predators. Your leading anxiety is you know, the desire to survive. Life is a jungle. It's kill or be killed. You're being hunted by predators. You really don't have time to think of others. You're simply trying to survive yourself. And so there we have persecutory anxiety. I don't even like calling it persecutory guilt. I kind of want to reserve the word guilt for the guilt of the reparative position.
Yes.
When we're in the depressive reparative position, other people are real to us. We not only are able to empathize with them. I think of empathy as merely a cognitive act of knowing how you feel. Many psychopaths are wonderfully empathic. They know exactly how their victims feel. They just don't give a damn. We need to go beyond empathy to sympathy in the depressive position, where I not only know how you feel, but I care and I wish to relieve your pain. And if I've inflicted the pain, I am now feeling mature guilt, depressive reparative guilt about that. So we have these fundamentally two different kinds of guilt. Regarding the chuntering and the rumination, I guess I think of it as diagnostically in terms of the degree. I mean, in patients who are operating in the PS position, the chuntering is simply a form of self-attack. It's a form of self-torment and self-inhibition. I think the same thing applies when this is going on with people who are operating more in the depressive reparative position, but to a much lesser degree. So I really do think it's a matter of degree, and it's a matter of which of the two positions the patient is fundamentally operating in.
Do you have an understanding about what has contributed, or better said, in your clinical experiences when you've encountered individuals who struggle in these various positions? Is there something common developmentally that you've noticed that has contributed to one or the other?
Yes. Well, you mentioned trauma. I think when we get the more severe kind of rumination, there usually is a history of trauma. I mean, I'm thinking of one patient. Now, his problems began earlier than the episode I'll describe. His mother really believed in the work ethic, and she put her children out into the picking patch, picking berries, when they were very, very young. And he developed tremendous anxiety about whether the pail would be filled enough with berries. And he had a major hate going on for the mother, who really was depriving him of childhood and childhood play by putting he and his sister out there at a very early age. And but then a few years later, he was out hunting for grouse or partridge with his uncle and his father. This was in the country, in the northwest U.S., and he hadn't bagged a bird in a few weeks, and his budding masculinity was associated with his prowess as a hunter, and he heard something moving, and he fired, and it was his dog, and he had to watch his uncle put a bullet in his beloved dog's head. And this was absolutely devastating for this man. And anytime he has to really assert himself, possibly by assigning a grade to a student paper or writing a letter, pulling the trigger seems to risk another disaster, asserting himself in this way. And so he ruminates and he delays and he procrastinates. And this is a form of self-torture. It's driven by tremendous anxiety. It's also driven by a fantasy of omnipotence. You know, he feels that he could possibly be omnipotently destructive and therefore has to interfere with himself, shut himself down. And that's one of the main functions. So there's this trauma history that I frequently find when the chuntering is severe.
Mm-hmm. A key piece of your observation is this differentiation between the narcissistic element and the object-related element. And you mention omnipotence. And patients, in my experience, will often refer to themselves in the second and third person, like, I want to be the kind of person who would, as opposed to actually caring about somebody. Mm-hmm. And it takes some effort to point out that in their effort to be a certain type of person, that they are posing, a phrase I use is often, you're posing for an internal camera or you're staring in front of the mirror. You're not really involved either with the object in their mind, or obviously it plays out in the transference where we are simply a witness to their orgy of self-abuse, or they're actually involved in being curious about the other person, in this case, the analyst. Can you share with us some technical thoughts on how you listen for these levels of self and other involvement and what kind of interventions you make in the face of them?
Well, I start by listening to our colleagues. I mean, I think we psychoanalysts, it's not just our patients, but we have been very confused about this. A lot of colleagues seem to think of morality in terms of the ego and the ego ideal. I'm measuring my real ego against my ego ideal. But not too many people have pointed out that this is a purely narcissistic act.
Yeah.
it's like people who want to be good parents because they want to see themselves as good parents.
That's right.
They want to be seen as good parents, as opposed to simply loving their kid. And the kid certainly knows the difference between the parenting that's coming from the narcissistic concern and the parenting that's coming from genuine love of the kid.
And when it comes into the transference, one of the initial obstacles that one finds is patients will say, well, I'm not supposed to be curious about you. I'm not supposed to wonder where you went on vacation or what your families are like or the various things that people struggle with acknowledging curiosity over. So in a sense, the cartoon image of the frame where we're blank screen kind of thing, right. or nowadays it's no longer you to hear blank screen so much, but I know that's a boundary violation. I can't be curious about you. That sort of fosters that self-involvement and doesn't help the person distinguish that no one ever said you can't be fully curious about all kinds of things. What I answer based on what I think is best is something that we can talk about, but please be present in your fullness with me.
Right. Right. Well, I think we ourselves are mostly responsible for this because you know, we have talked a whole lot about the frame and about abstinence, yeah, and about neutrality. And we scold colleagues who we feel are too self-revealing. And then there are those terrible metaphors that Freud used of the analyst as a surgeon. I mean, I don't think our patients got this from nothing. If they've read any of the analytic literature, I think a lot of it feeds this kind of thing. It's taken me years to become comfortable with self-revelation. I mean, I don't seek to hide myself from my patients. I'm not going to use their time and money to go into long discussions of my problems with my mother, obviously. But if they want to know how I'm feeling or what I think, I usually will tell them. But I usually want to follow up or even begin with the question as to why they want to hear this or what do they imagine, I think. But after they're through telling me what they imagine, I think, if they still want to know what I really think, I will tell them what I really think. I mean, mm-hmm, I've increasingly come to see the analytic relationship as a real relationship between two real human beings. It's a bounded relationship. And obviously, we need to be clear about that. And sometimes patients need to be directly told what the boundary is, but it's certainly, but that's about physical. That's a physical boundary. There isn't going to be any touch. There isn't going to be any hugs. But leaving beyond that, if they want to know what I'm thinking or I'm feeling, I am going to truthfully tell them. I mean, one of the things I most appreciate in Freud and in Wilfred Bion is their absolute insistence that analytic treatment must be carried on in a fully truthful way. I just think we haven't taken that fully seriously.
You bring up the phrase self-revelation, and I think we should spend a moment on it because without anticipating it, it's a perfect example of the two phases that you've described in your work. That is, when the field warns against self-revelation, what I have understood them to be warning against is don't get caught up in yourself, analyst. Like you just said, the patient is not there for your gratification.
Right.
There are undoubtedly, so the voice says, you know, self-gratifications that you're seeking in revealing yourself. And therefore, the remedy for that is best to say nothing. As if the field can't imagine that one might choose to be self-revealing for the purpose of illuminating something that's going on between the two individuals, for the purpose of introducing the authenticity of the patient's curiosity about you, that object relatedness that puts it in the depressive position as opposed to the narcissistic position. And I think that's what you just said, and I think it's important that you did say it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And also just, there's something democratic about it. The analyst is a living, breathing human being who has feelings. And the patient is often interested in what we feel. And
for hosts of reasons.
Lots of reasons.
Yes, yes, sure. Do you have clinical examples that will flesh this out for our listeners to get a sense of what these different stages look like in the office and in the relationship?
The different stages, you mean between PS and D, you mean?
Yes, and PS, just so for those who are not usual or familiar with the terms, PS, paranoid schizoid, and D, depressive.
Right.
And depressive doesn't mean depressed. It means actually related to another person.
Because by calling it depressive position, she had depressive anxiety in mind, not depression. And yes. Depressive anxiety is my fear that I've irreparably harmed you. Is there time to get you to the emergency room? Right. It's not about depression. Depression belongs in the paranoid schizoid. Mm-hmm. Because anything that's worth the term depression involves splitting, right? If I can remember my goodness when I'm looking at my badness, I'm not depressed. I may be regretful, remorseful, sad, but I'm not depressed. But okay, so these two fundamentally different territories, and one of the things I appreciate about Kleinian thought is the insistence that we oscillate. All of us oscillate between the two positions. We're not talking about two different kinds of human beings. We're talking about all human beings. And some people make briefer trips to the paranoid schizoid position, and some people mostly live there. So people are different in this respect. But everybody goes a little crazy sometimes. People speak of bad moods. And they say, oh, I'm sorry, honey, I wasn't myself. Well, you were yourself. You were yourself in the paranoid schizoid position, you know. And some people are better than others at digging themselves quickly out of that and returning to the more object-related concern position. So we all oscillate. When we're working with patients who live predominantly or a great deal of the time in the paranoid schizoid position, we know this by looking at our countertransference. You know, there's that oversimplifying statement that the Freudians analyze the transference, the Kleinians analyze the countertransference. Mm-hmm. We all do both, actually, but I think there is a difference. I think people informed by Klein are watching their own emotional reactions. And when you are sitting on the edge of your chair, and you have that feeling that you're walking in a bit of a minefield and you have to walk very carefully or a bomb is going to go off, you know you're sitting with a patient who's in the paranoid schizoid position and you are feeling anxiety as a result. You're feeling their anxiety. They are making you anxious because they may very well be ready to attack. The whole thing becomes very fraught. You are not a relaxed analyst. You're not able to think very clearly because you're being stirred up. Primitive anxieties are being stirred in you. That's how we know where the patient's at, I think, by watching our own countertransference reaction in that way. With patients who are operating in the more mature depressive position, we're much more relaxed. If we make a mistake, we have the sense that it can be repaired. Everything is not so desperate. Very different feeling.
And it should be emphasized that that countertransference, or those two different types of countertransference, often reflect the patient's experience as a child. That is, that we are sitting at the edge of our seat, frightened about what we might do wrong, as it were.
Yeah.
Often can be traced back to exactly what the patient experienced on an ongoing basis as a child, and it's sort of a gift, as it were, that the patient gives us to help us understand, unknowingly helps us understand what their early life was like.
Yeah, they're aiding our empathy because we're feeling the way they felt, and the roles are reversed. They are intimidating parent, and the intimidated child is put into us. It does aid our empathy.
Yes. One of the points you've made that I have found valuable in my work is when working with patients who are in this paranoid state, that when you make interventions designed to bring awareness to them, to have them learn something about themselves that you hope will make their lives easier, will be informative, will be useful for them, and that's the spirit with which you make it, it is often received as nothing more than a put down.
Right.
And that really checkmates the analyst, because our instrument of help is to intervene in what we imagine is a beneficial way. But of course, what we do and what's received is not the same thing. But and since their sense of themselves is always, am I worthwhile or am I not worthwhile? And that's the two speeds they have when they're in this state. We're really stuck, because if we try to help them see something, all they hear us as saying is, you're bad.
Right. Right. And that can really handcuff us, yeah, or disempower us in many ways, especially to the extent that, you know, maybe we've worked in our careers a lot with neurotic patients, mm-hmm, and they can receive and benefit from interpretations, and they can make us feel good for being able to be clever and articulate. And so we're doing this hermeneutic thing. The good neurotic patient is bringing their dreams, and we decode these together, and they free associate. We're used to this way of working. And then we encounter someone who is functioning in the paranoid schizoid position, and this old way of working, it just doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, we flounder. I think with experience, well, look, it all depends on how deeply regressed the patient is. Let's go all the way to psychosis, because the paranoid schizoid position covers both psychotic, yeah, and borderline conditions. There was a wonderful paper written, I think, in the 1940s by Kurt Eisler called The Psychoanalysis of Schizophrenia. And one of the points he makes there is that we might be able to figure out the psychodynamics that are going on in the delusional psychosis, perhaps, but trying to explain any of this or give any of this knowledge to the patient is absolutely useless. He said it would be more useless for us to spoon some food into the patient's mouth, or, you know, help him go to sleep, or go for a walk with him.
Sure.
So I think we need to keep that in mind.
Meaning speaking the patient's language? Is that your point?
Yeah, speaking the patient's language, and also moving out of any kind of a technical paradigm into a much more human paranoid. This patient is absolutely terrified, feels like he's about to be killed. So we become reassuring.
Sure.
We calm the patient. Now, with patients who are not so psychotic, but still suffering from a whole lot of paranoid anxiety, I think we have to do an awful lot more than interpret. I do think we need to reassure. We need to absolutely build an atmosphere of safety and trust. Sometimes we need to join the resistance. I'm not a Spotnitzian modern analyst, but Spotnitz and Meadow and their colleagues, they got somewhere with very ill people by using some of their joining the resistance.
I mean, can you say something about that? It's something I think people do, but they don't use the phrase join the resistance, but I learned it long ago, and I find it useful. Can you flesh it out a little bit?
Sure. Well, I married one. she's straight.
Well, that's okay. One way to learn it. For those of us who haven't, help us out here.
Basically, Freud was on to this. I mean, remember, when Freud started, resistance was something to be conquered. He used that military language, you know, conquer the resistance. Yeah. And then he gradually realized, but wait a minute, it's not just to be conquered, it's to be analyzed. It's an opportunity to study the patient's resistance. And so psychoanalysis became resistance analysis or defense analysis, which indicated a greater degree of respect for the resistance. The patient has a reason to be resisting, and we need to respect the patient's resistances and analyze them. Well, the Spotnitz people went even further. They're not only respecting the resistance, but they're even joining it and sometimes even advocating it.
For example, what does that mean?
Okay, well... I'm thinking of a patient who approached me after I spoke at a conference, and she said she'd had four shrinks and none of them were able to help her at all with her bulimia. And she thought, I was just the man. I could do it. I'm the shrink who would do this for her. Could she come to see me? And I guess I was thinking along modern analytic lines. And so I said, well, I'm very busy. And in any case, what's so bad about barfing from time to time? I mean, things could be a lot worse. As symptoms go, I mean, I don't know. I don't really know whether that's. But you know, if you want to come and talk to me, so she did. But I just did not talk to her about bulimia. I would talk to her about all kinds of other things.
But you were speaking to her about her idealization of you, in a sense. You were putting distance. You were saying, well, you think I'm the best person to help you with this terrible symptom. The symptom's not so terrible, and I'm not so fabulous.
Yeah, exactly. I'm doing that. But it's also like with an alcoholic patient, you're the guy who's going to help me conquer my alcoholism. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I am not. So he comes after one session and says, you know, he stopped drinking altogether. Now, if I were a Spotnitzian, I might say, are you sure that's wise? We're stopping already. Mm-hmm. We've barely gotten started here. We don't even know what alcohol really means for you. And you're telling me you're stopping it. I'm not going to say no, don't stop. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to ask him, you know, are you being maybe a bit premature? I'm not going to let him put me in the position of the guy who's going to make him stop drinking because he will defeat me.
Sure. You're not accepting the seduction.
Right.
Don, you have also extended your understanding of the superego and the conscience, two terms that you've used to describe the state in each of these conditions, to social dimensions. You've written about the importance for society of respecting the presence of guilt of the reparative sort, and have noted with chagrin the relative absence of that in our culture nowadays. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, Freud was worried about the buildup of guilt as a product of civilization, because to be civilized, we have to suppress our antisocial inclinations, and the repression of those causes this buildup of guilt. But he had only persecutory guilt in mind, and the implication was that we needed a lot less guilt in civilization. Well, we do need less persecutory guilt, but we need a heck of a lot more reparative guilt. Right now in America, we're seeing the transformation between a president who, the ex now, thankfully, ex-president, who was operating pretty much all the time in the paranoid schizoid position, deeply narcissistic, sunk in narcissism, cruel. And now we have a very different atmosphere in the White House with Joe Biden. I mean, I have many criticisms to make of Biden and Harris. I'm way to the left of these people. But nevertheless, I have to acknowledge the radical change of atmosphere. I mean, I think Biden has genuine concern for other people and for the welfare of the nation, suffering massively under the pandemic and the terrible economic repercussions of the pandemic. So we've moved from narcissism to concern. It's right in front of us, this change.
In that same paper of yours, your 2006 paper, which I recommend to our audience, your closing sentence is the following. If advance in civilization entails an increased capacity to confront and bear guilt, then a first step may be to learn to speak its true language, not least by ceasing to confuse it with the self-torment that represents its evasion.
Right.
Like many of your sentences, it's very rich, and I'd like you to unpack it a little bit. The first part is about advance in civilization entails an increased capacity to confront and bear guilt, A. And B, I do want to emphasize this point you make, because few people make it as clearly as you. The confusion between self-torment and the experience of guilt. Your point is exactly the opposite of that, that self-torment is a narcissistic state.
Yes.
And it is not object-related guilt or what you call conscience. So why don't we start off with that and then we'll go to the social issue.
Okay, well, it's very painful, self-torment, persecutory guilt. The superego is lacerating you. That's very, very painful. But it's remarkable and strikes me as kind of paradoxical that many people prefer to go on being lacerated by their superego, having this persecutory guilt. They prefer that to the move into the depressive position where they could begin to experience real concern for the other and the mature reparative guilt. Why? Because of the narcissism and because of splitting. These are people who can't acknowledge any bad in themselves, because for them, because they split, any bad will spread like ink in the water, and they'll become all bad.
Yeah.
And that is, to them, seems even worse than beating themselves up the way they do with painful symptoms and so on. As painful as all that is, it seems less threatening to them than the danger of admitting that, yes, they do wrong, bad things. They do sin from time to time because they can't offset that with any awareness of their goodness or their innocence. They become all bad. And if you really see yourself as an all bad thing, you pretty much have to kill yourself. I mean, you become suicidal. Well, why not? Why would you? How can you go on living if you are an all bad, poisonous thing? They just can't see gradations of badness and goodness.
And from a treatment point of view, what comes to my mind is Lowell's famous observation that it's vital for an ongoing treatment, for a depth treatment, for the analyst to have a picture in his or her mind of who that patient can be, which is another way to say not just what kind of job they will have, but their essential goodness that the patient may not be in tune with, that the analyst has to hold that goodness often.
Right.
And that's what makes the treatment so vital, is for the patient to come to assume that inside themselves.
Yeah, I think that's profoundly true. It's sometimes hard for the analyst to do it.
You bet. Yes.
I mean, I've worked with a few psychopaths, and I do believe that even psychopaths, we used to think they don't have a conscience. No, they do. They just are very talented at gagging it and binding it and not hearing it. But it's there. I think they still have a true self. I think it's there too. But it's these things in certain very ill psychopathic patients, these things are so deeply buried. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I do believe the analyst has to have, it's almost an act of faith. It's a little analogous to, the Catholic idea of like the deathbed conversion. I mean, a man has been sinning like crazy all of his life, but maybe at the end he actually can genuinely, and I don't mean just the fake drama, but I mean a genuine recognition and acknowledgement and turning. I think that may be possible for some people. I think that core of innocence is still there. It's just so deeply buried. The analyst has to have faith that it exists.
Yes. And then you say an advance in civilization entails an increased capacity to confront and bear guilt.
Right.
And by that you mean, is it also the same thing as saying an advance in civilization requires each of us to care about each other and to care about our impact on each other?
Well, I would make it more challenging than that by saying the advance depends on finally coming to understand what was meant in the Judeo-Christian doctrine of the fall of man. We're fallen. We're broken. We're sinners. We will always be sinners, even after we turn, even after salvation or redemption, we remain sinners. To be human is to be seriously flawed. To be human is to fail others. Now, we can progress, and we can fail others, and we can fail our own true selves less. And that's our task. That's our goal. That's our responsibility, to try to work day by day to improve, but with the knowledge that we will never be perfect, we will always continue to have to suffer reparative guilt, because we will always fall short. And that's part of the tragedy of being human, is trying to do better and sometimes succeeding in doing better, but still always falling short. That's the recognition, I think, that is crucial. Just the knowledge that being a human means I will and must continue to bear guilt. Because also the human condition involves us in binds where either way we go, we will do harm. Life puts us in this situation. We want to tell the truth, but sometimes telling the truth is being unkind. We want to pursue one good, but life has unfolded in such a way that to pursue one good is to betray another good.
Sure.
So we're going to wind up with blood on our hands, as it were, no matter what we do. And that's the human condition. And I think if one can accept that, begin to accept that, a kind of compassion for others and a kind of joining with others in what, in fact, is a kind of tragic situation that we're all in, a deeper kind of empathy can come out of that.
The challenge, what I hear you saying, which may be a little different than you mean it, the challenge is for us to be, like you said, the parent who's just actually caring for their child, not posing to be a caring parent.
Right.
Our task is not to pose to be a caring human being, but to the extent that it's genuine, to actually be interested affectively in the people in our lives and the world in which we live, and to live that.
But in order to live that, I want to emphasize that we need to know how sinful we are.
That is the beginning of a whole other conversation that you and I could have, Don, that we're not going to be able to have now. I know you have written about, and I've been interested in your own personal past in this area and your spiritual journeys as you've characterized them. And somehow that conversation and the one we've just had are related to each other in ways that we can't get to now, but it's sort of a teaser for next time. Don, thank you. Thank you for all you've written. Thank you for your thinking. I have found it, as I've mentioned, clinically helpful. I'm sure many of our listeners will feel the same and will be encouraged to turn to your writings to digest this more thoughtfully at their own pace. And I'm grateful for your joining this conversation.
Oh, thank you, Harvey. Your words are very kind, and I appreciate them.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.